Coming up on Valley Edition, how one COVID-19 coalition aims to rebuild trust in healthcare among Fresno's Black community, starting with cultural sensitivity training.
Saying ma'am and sir is something that's custom to us, whether you know them or not. So we had to make sure they understood, hey, we make sure you say a ma'am to Mrs. Green, because you know Ms. Green gonna get you if you don't come correct to her, you know?
Plus, for the first time ever, Hmong New Year in Fresno is canceled. How the community is coping with the loss of tradition and social connection.
I think every Hmong community has a family, you know, atmosphere, but ours really is truly connected through that way. Our gathering is about family. Our food is about our family. Our event is about family. And the pandemic is not.
And a family in Parlier talks about losing their grandparents to COVID-19. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
Hey, it's Mary Louise Kelly from All Things Considered. It is membership month at Valley Public Radio, and that means it is time for you to do some of the heavy lifting for us. All year long, this station brings informative and balanced news coverage to you no matter where you are. All we ask is that you do what you can to support those efforts by becoming a sustaining member. Just $20 per month makes the work we do possible. Please take a minute, visit kvpr.org or the KVPR app today, and click donate. And thank you.
Well, do what Mary Louise Kelly says. Go to kvpr.org or the KVPR app and click donate. Hi, I'm David Alice with Valley Public Radio. It's the final day of our winter membership drive. We're looking for your support right now to help us end the year strong. If you've relied on Valley Public Radio throughout the year, we're asking you to help us get a great start to the next year by giving a gift right now. Think of it not just as a gift, even you can think of it as an investment, right, Valerie?
Yeah, think of your contribution to FM89 as an investment, whether it's $100 or $1,000, whether it's $20 a month or more, that investment will generate thousands of hours of value to you, to your community, and beyond. The more listeners we have who are taking that all-important step and becoming members today, the healthier and more prosperous this station will be. It's such a weight off of your shoulders when you don't have to worry about personal finances, and that's the same exact thing that's happening at Valley Public Radio. These reporters are thinking, okay, I can report on whatever important things happen in the Valley because I know that I have the next paycheck coming.
That's right. Yeah. So if you've come to rely on this programming, it takes time, it takes effort, it takes human power, but it takes money to make all of this happen. So we're asking for your support. Do a one-time gift or become a sustaining member. As a sustaining member, certain amount every month at the $30 level, you can be a day sponsor, and that's a great way to give. Or $15 a month, you're eligible to be wearing the latest and greatest in fashion, brand new 2021 Valley Public Radio socks. It's their hip retro 80s design to let all of your friends know that you are a supporter of public radio and that you're also on the cutting edge of design. However we give, we ask that you give right now, kvpr.org or the KVPR app.
Giving a gift to the station is a great way to actually give a gift to someone in your life. For the person who has everything, you can give a gift in their honor to the station and they go, oh, thank you. You didn't clutter my house anymore. You gave me a memory. It's a beautiful thing to be able to bestow that upon someone else, especially during this holiday season.
Oh, I really like that. Yep. And sustaining gift is a great way to do it. As you, for your own household budget, the benefit of sustaining a gift is it lets you plan your giving and parcel it out throughout the year, so you know how much you're giving every month. And for Valley Public Radio, when we have more sustaining members, we have a better idea how much revenue we have coming in every month throughout the year. So we can plan and use that money even more wisely, continue to invest in a growing news team, to invest in programming that you have asked for and that you want to hear, to invest in some technology changes that we've had to make this year to make sure that we're staying online, on the air, strong and proud. All that takes money, and we can't do it without you. Whatever level feels good to you, we ask for you to give now.
KVPR.org or on the KVPR mobile app, all you have to do is hit donate, and the process is easy as pie.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the roots of Fresno's high eviction rates go back to redlining. And due to COVID-19, the largest Hmong New Year celebration in the country won't take place this year. But first, COVID-19 is hitting Black Americans particularly hard. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they're nearly twice as likely as whites to contract the virus and almost three times as likely to die from it. But because of a history of unethical treatment by the medical system, getting resources to them can also be a challenge. As FM89's Carrie Klein reports, one effort in Fresno is leveraging community members to rebuild trust while tamping down on the outbreak.
It's a Tuesday afternoon in downtown Fresno, and a line of cars has wrapped around the block from the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission to Chuck Chansey Stadium. A petite karaoke singer belts out 70s ballads on the sidewalk as they all wait for Testing Tuesday to begin.
We do the rapid antigen test, and then we also do the PCR.
Shante Davies-Balge organized today's event as the lead of Fresno's African American Coalition. The clinic will serve anyone, but it aims to bring in members of a demographic that will often put off care out of mistrust of the medical system.
There's been generations and generations of mistreatment of Black and brown bodies, and it's going to take, you know, time before that trust has been fully restored.
Black Americans have undergone centuries of abuse at the hands of science and medicine, going as far back as experimental surgeries on slaves. But one hugely unethical study by the U.S. government ended just 50 years ago, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, in which hundreds of Black men with syphilis were never told when the life-saving drug penicillin became available. Researchers continued to study them as the disease ravaged their bodies. Building trust and improving COVID-19 outcomes is one reason Davies-Balge formed the African American Coalition.
Okay, so this is our star UCSF testing team, our testing partners.
It's an arm of the Fresno COVID-19 Equity Project, a massive collaboration of dozens of organizations, as well as UCSF Fresno, that bring COVID-19 testing and resources to Fresno's most vulnerable groups.
So the first approach that we took really was to engage directly with the Black community and partner with folks from the communities that we're trying to serve.
Like Brittany Wilson, a master's student in public health who joined the coalition as a contact tracer and resource specialist. She's wearing a bedazzled mask and face shield.
The mistrust that's so rooted in our community as far as healthcare, I want to be on the opposite end of that. And I want my kids on the opposite end of that.
Her team doesn't just offer tests and information. They make sure people who test positive leave with an isolation kit containing thermometers, face shields, and a book for logging symptoms. And they screen for mental health needs, all to make self-isolation a little less daunting.
We have meal delivery, that we have these services so you can stay home, giving them access to the county orders, which a lot of them don't even know exist. And they're like, what? And I'm like, go to this website, click here, and it'll pull it up.
Wilson and her colleagues were also trained for more than 40 hours in cultural sensitivity practices, learning language to use and common issues that could come up.
Saying ma'am and sir is something that's custom to us, whether you know them or not. So we had to make sure they understood, hey, we make sure you're saying ma'am to Mrs. Green, because you know Ms. Green gonna get you if you don't come correct to her, you know?
The coalition can test only 50 people each Tuesday.
Perfect. Circle it around 5 times in both nostrils.
And the day I'm there, they reach that ceiling within 40 minutes. But most of those people are not Black. That's something Aaron Foster noticed.
So if you really look at them, how many of them look like me?
Foster is an advocate with many groups, including Advance Peace, It's a program that aims to end gun violence, partly by walking door-to-door in risky neighborhoods. Foster proposed taking the same approach with the coalition, and Shante Davies-Balch agreed. Soon, he'll be knocking on those same doors in predominantly black neighborhoods, this time offering COVID-19 tests.
We have laser focus. It's very intentional. When we hit these doors, we make appointments and we show up.
The coalition's reliance on grassroots organizations and community leaders like Foster has been a model for other programs around the state. That's why Brittany Wilson is so excited about her work.
Proud. I'm proud when I go home.
It's also stressful, she says, but she feels good knowing she's helped at least a few people each day. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The largest Hmong New Year celebration in the country is held at the end of every December in Fresno. But for the first time ever, the event is canceled due to the pandemic. FM89's Sarith Hawk reports on how that's affecting the community, economically and culturally.
Chong Jie Veng opens the gates to his Sanger home. Okay, hello. And walks the gravel driveway leading to his 2.5-acre property. This is where he spends most of his time now.
I'm 80. I'm a young man, 80 years old.
The Vietnam War veteran has been confined to his home during the pandemic, keeping busy with chores.
I had nothing to do, so I had to walk around and clean up and, you know, water all the tree, all the fruit, you know, that's what I do.
Vang lives with his youngest son. But after his wife died 2 years ago, the house has been even more quiet. That's why Hmong New Year was especially important for him. The week-long celebration in late December means he gets to visit with relatives and friends from all over the country.
New Year, everybody come and you see each other, shake hands, hold, hug each other. But this year, no way you can see them, you can hug anybody.
Long Zhang, executive director of the nonprofit Fresno Asian Business Institute and Resource Center, says the lack of connection caused by the New Year cancellation is devastating.
I think everybody community has a family, you know, atmosphere, but ours really is truly connected through that way. Our gathering is about family. Our food is about our family. Our event is about family, and the pandemic is not.
But Zhang says they're not just missing out on a huge social gathering. The Hmong New Year is also a financial boost to the city and hundreds of vendors.
Here, when it comes down to Fresno, you know, where you've always averaged anywhere from 70 to 100,000 folks that come to the city, you look at the economic impact that has not only within our Hmong community here, but throughout the city.
An economic impact that directly affects the most vulnerable businesses, he says. Small business owners in immigrant communities have always dealt with added challenges in finding resources. Language barriers, lack of access to technology. But the pandemic has made the need more urgent and crucial for survival. A canceled New Year celebration adds to that pressure.
And many of the small businesses that we talk to that does jewelry, that does some of the clothing, that sell kind of cultural things are directly impacted because many of these small businesses rely on the New Year to be part of half of their yearly income to, or even more.
And on top of the social and economic losses of the New Year cancellation, many in the Hmong community are already suffering from depression and anxiety because they've lost loved ones to the pandemic.
And many of them staying are in disbelief and are really in grieving right now. So why my mother? Why my father? Why my son? Why my daughter? We are in America. Why can't they be saved by medicine, right?
That's Dr. Gia Zhang, director of the Living Well program at the Fresno Center. He says the New Year cancellation only compounds the loss of other traditions, including funerals. Ceremonies that usually last several days have been cut short to one day or even hours during the pandemic.
It's changing the way they live their life, changing the way they conduct a lot of these traditions and practice and rituals. It's really significant.
But he says one result of the pandemic and the cancellation of important events is people are now finding other ways to connect.
And this whole idea of FaceTime, this whole idea of Facebook, I think even with older folks, they're now beginning to see the value of that.
Still, the loss of Hmong New Year is hard to take, especially for older folks like Chong Jie Vang and Sanger, who don't get to see their friends.
I don't know. I feel so sad and not like the in the past. You know, this year, everything has changed. And you couldn't do anything about that.
For a culture rich in traditions, this Hmong New Year will have to be about honoring rituals without those real-life connections. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. For some families, COVID-19 has been ruthless, affecting many generations, from grandparents to grandchildren. FM89's news director Alice Daniels spoke with one family in Parlier whose members were in four different hospitals all at the same time.
Brianna Cisneros is the youngest of four siblings.
I'm 9 years old.
She's sitting at a picnic table in her backyard with her two sisters, her brother, and her father. A dog barks nearby. There's music playing from a neighbor's house down the street. Signs of normalcy in a not-so-normal year. In the span of about a week back in July, Brianna's parents and her oldest sister were all sick with COVID in different hospitals in the valley. And that same week, her grandparents both died of the virus in a hospital in Los Angeles. They lived in Parlier, but were in LA when they got sick.
I was really close to them. My grandma would always take me to the park. She would take care of me, take me and my brother and sometimes my sister to the bus stop.
She misses them. And when she thinks back to that horrible week this past summer, well, it's something she's still trying to make sense of.
It's scary for someone small to think about something big, you know, that happened.
Something big that happened. It's what the whole family has been thinking about, especially now around the holidays. It's unclear how they contracted the virus. They wore masks, they say, and were careful. But they want to share their story so that others will stay vigilant and won't experience the pain they did.
I cried every day, every night.
That's Brianna's oldest sister, Jeanette. She's 23, and she's describing what it was like to be by herself at Clovis Community Medical Center with COVID, knowing that her parents and grandparents were also sick with the virus in other hospitals.
It was very, very difficult for me, and all by yourself, and sorry. It was really, really difficult.
She didn't even know she had COVID when she came to the hospital. She was there to have a baby, and she was tested for the virus.
And a few hours after is when I started having a fever, shortness of breath, chills, headache.
She says labor was especially difficult because she was having so much trouble just breathing. After her son David was born, nurses asked Jeanette's husband to bring him home. Jeanette stayed for several more days because she was so sick.
Doctor called me, was saying, your daughter's sick.
That's Rodolfo Cisneros. When Jeanette's doctor called him, Rodolfo was also in a hospital with COVID, an hour away in Hanford. His wife, meanwhile, had been transferred to a hospital in Lodi. All Rodolfo could do was ask the doctor to take good care of his daughter.
Please, you know, take care of him because, you know, I am in the hospital too.
He says he lost 20 pounds and, like Jeanette, required oxygen. At one point, he was worried for his life.
It was scary. I was thinking bad. I mean, you know, what's going to happen to me?
Meanwhile, the three kids still at home struggled to keep everything together. They say they each had minor symptoms of COVID, like headaches, but were never tested. To stay in touch with his parents, 15-year-old Rodolfo Jr. says technology helped, but it also made him anxious.
You could text your parents anytime you want, and I would get worried when they wouldn't answer.
19-year-old Valeria says the uncertainty of that week was awful.
So hard because, I mean, I saw everyone like leaving the hospital, and I try to
be strong for my siblings too.
When their grandparents died, the kids were alone.
My family and I agreed to not tell my parents and my sister yet because they were both not doing well. And so we kind of had to grieve by ourselves.
And as COVID cases spike in the valley, it's something she hopes other families are able to avoid. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
Hey, it's David Green here. And even though I'm going to be transitioning soon away from my role at NPR, I will always support the public radio station in my community. Like you, I want to be informed and enlightened and entertained by stories from a trusted source. California and the Central Valley have had so much going on this year, and Valley Public Radio has been with you every step of the way. Right now, it's membership month, and your support of this station keeps the programming you rely on strong and available for you every single day. Go to kvpr.org, and thanks so much for listening.
Hi, I'm another David. I'm David Alse with Valley Public Radio. Great to hear that message from David Green. Today's the last day of our winter membership drive. With me today is Valerie Smart, listener and supporter. Hey, Valerie, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, I love listening to the dulcet tones of David Green and David Alse here. It's so nice when one of the big shots from corporate back at NPR can give a message to us in the Valley here. David Green does excellent reporting, and so does everyone at the Valley Public Radio Station.
That's right, Valerie. And, you know, in times like these, we need reliable news and information more than ever. And as David Green said, it's been a heck of a year, and Valley Public Radio and NPR have been with you all the way through the year. Wherever the news takes us, we bring you the facts. From the fires to the pandemic to the protests to the election and more, Valley Public Radio has been there for you with information you can trust. We like to cut through the noise to bring you the information that matters. And we know that for listeners like you, staying informed is more than just the news or the headlines or sound bites or talking points. It's about in-depth stories and lifelong learning. And we like to go beyond the headlines to bring you voices and stories that help you understand your world.
So lifelong learning is an important part of being an adult, I like to think. And we're listening to Valley Edition now, and we're learning more and more relevant things to our daily lives. Maybe it is something that you knew about. Maybe it's something you've always wanted to know more about. That's what's so great about what's offered on this station.
That's right. And the hard work of our reporting team cannot be emphasized enough through this year, a year full of challenges like we've been talking about. A relentless year of news cycle upon news cycle upon news cycle. And in the face of all that, our news team have been absolutely relentless themselves in keeping up with total rock stars. And through it all, too, still figuring out ways to do long-form journalism with in-depth stories in a way that you can't hear or won't hear anywhere else. Year in and year out, our news team gets commended for their work. For the second year in a row, Valley Public Radio has won a regional Edward R. Murrow Award this year. And we also won 4 Golden Mike Awards earlier this year for the Southern California Radio Television News Association, including the Best News Reporting and Best Public Affairs Programming, which is Valley Edition. So we'd love to hear your support right now. Great way to support is to become a sustaining member. What's a sustaining member, Valerie?
A sustaining member is an elite class of public radio nerd that's actually accessible to anyone who listens. You can become a sustaining member by pledging $5, $10, $20 a month, even more if you'd like, whatever suits your budget, through kvpr.org or the KVPR mobile app. So all you have to do is set it up and the radio station gets that amount every month without having to lift a finger.
That's right. It's quick, easy, safe, and secure to set up. It only takes a minute, and we need you to do it right now. Go to kvpr.org or the KVPR app and click donate, and we thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The nonprofit news organization Retro Report is working on a documentary project looking at the high eviction rates in 3 cities in the U.S., including Fresno. According to Retro Report field producer Daniel Caceres, the roots of Fresno's eviction rates go all the way back to the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and the discriminatory practice of redlining. That's when people of color are denied access to housing and loans within specific neighborhoods. I spoke with Caceres about the project, and he started by talking about some of Fresno's most vulnerable communities.
Well, throughout the Central Valley, it seems that undocumented immigrants have always been the targets of landlords operating outside of the law. I know this is true today, simply with migrant workers living on some farms in such horrible, horrible conditions. So what of the poor people living in our communities? Many of them are also field workers, restaurant workers, considered essential, some getting paid under the table. Now here we have COVID. How are they living now? And that's what we wanted to find out.
And tell me about some of the things that you have uncovered in the course of your reporting. Give us a sense of the people that you've encountered.
Oh, this has been so amazing. And the people that I've spoken to, I literally pounded the pavement in Southwest Fresno around the Kearney Boulevard neighborhoods in Calwa near Fresno Fairgrounds. Mask on, N95 on, and social distancing. I was always respectful because, well, in case you don't know, up to about when I was about maybe 8 or 9 or 10, I grew up in Calwa. I grew up among, you know, in a farm working family. And so I was always respectful of the people that I spoke to, and many of them were undocumented farm workers. And what I found was, is that the struggle during this time of COVID is just immense on them. They're going through so much with regard to past due bills, and they need to keep their phones on to find work. Restaurants are being closed and open and then closed again. Their children are learning from home. There is no place in the house for them to learn that is of a good amount of space for them to hear what's going on coming through their small, tiny little Chromebooks, and they're behind on rent. Well, how are they going to pay rent if they're not working? And, you know, some of the examples are of a young couple living in South Fresno. They told me that they were being harassed by their landlord. They're both restaurant workers, and they did everything they could to pay the rent. In fact, they paid the rent before even buying food, buying gasoline for their car. The gentleman would walk to work. And they told the landlady that, hey, we're not going to be able to make this month's rent. We could pay you this much. And what they told me was that she was okay with it. There was never any talk of any moratorium on evictions. They weren't aware of it. No one knows that the landlord was aware of it. They had so many bills, like about a $400 water bill, at least a $500 PG&E bill, a power bill, at least a $1,200 telephone bill, and numerous other bills. And on top of everything else, she had just turned in her car so that she could buy a newer used vehicle. When the impacts came from COVID and the shutdown came, well, they lost all of their money that they were putting down on the car. And she no longer had the old car. It was just gone. The stress on them was so much that they separated. And at this time, the landlord was on them. I need the money. I need the money. And he is undocumented and was asking him, are you going to become a documented citizen? Are you going to get married to become a legal resident? And she would come over, as they told me, she would come over, and if they didn't answer the door in time, she would literally go around and knock on windows to try to get them to answer the door. They separated in the end, and they had a little dog. And so the landlord said, that dog is not on the lease, and you have this amount of time to get out. So what started as an informal eviction turned into a formal eviction. That's just one right there. There was a second one in Calwa, South Fresno as well, where the landlord would not recognize the eviction moratorium. And so this person had to get legal help through legal services here in Fresno, and was protected. However, during that time, there was leaking water coming from underneath of the bathtub. That water, and he did not know how long, started mold underneath the bed of his three children, young children, the oldest being 12. And he did not know that this was going on. He's cleaning and he turns over the bed and there's over 2 feet of mold. These are the people who are the most vulnerable.
Are there any realistic solutions that are being discussed, both in the short term and in the long term?
Well, Kathleen, there's always something being discussed, but a realistic plan really needs to be fulfilled. So when we talk about short and long-term solutions, well, a plan must come into play, or we will simply have the return of rent-burdened families. And rent-burdened families are those families who are paying over 45, 50% or more toward their rent monthly and struggling to make ends meet. So we need a plan for affordable housing. And prior to COVID, there was a shortage of at least 35,000 homes, affordable rentals for people to be renting. So what we need is more affordable housing.
So you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the eviction moratoriums. Can you just bring us up to date on where those stand?
A tenant cannot be evicted if they missed rent from, well, March through August. And that's when the pandemic hit. And for rent from September through January 31, well, renters must have at least 25% of the monthly rent to be protected from eviction. And this can be paid at any time. But there's people out there who cannot come up with the 25%. And in Fresno alone, there's at least 80,000 rentals. So why are we hearing in California that people are still being evicted? Because landlords have found legal causes to evict. If a tenant didn't prove they are affected by COVID, or they didn't simply tell the landlord and they did not fill in the legal papers that they are required to sign within 15 days of each month. Now, this eviction protection is going to expire. And on February 1, unless there is a, unless our California legislators extend this protection, well, then that means people can be evicted again. And keep in mind, everything will need to be paid by March 2021. Without an extension, people are going to be scrambling to find a place to live. And, you know, us journalists, we're all calling it a tsunami evictions. And many will couch surf with friends, you know, but what of the families, entire families, children in school, what's going to happen to them who are in distance learning if they have to leave the area? So these households will suffer the most unless there is something done in the way of an extension.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for asking me to be here. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Back in May, I interviewed Amy Arland, a registered nurse who works in the ICU at Kaiser Fresno Medical Center. At the time, she was grieving the loss of one of her colleagues to COVID-19. It was an emotional conversation that touched many of our listeners. And now that ICU capacities in the Valley have reached the breaking point, I checked back in with Arland to see how she's holding up. This is what she had to say.
I was hoping this would be over after the second wave, and now I think we're well into a third wave that has turned into a tsunami. The fight has worn many of us down. I'm worn down. There has been so much death over the last 9 months now in our ICU, more so than I have had to witness in my 20-year career. And that has taken a toll that has left a scar. Of course, I'm going to continue to battle and fight against this virus, but I think that this has made a lot of us consider not staying in this career because of the psychological damage that has been done throughout this pandemic to the people working on the front lines.
Can you tell us what it's like in your ICU right now?
Very somber. Our mood, our morale has hit an all-time low. Even though this is the holidays, does not feel very cheerful. Our ICU is completely full. We know that we are out of beds. And I mean, nursing is just a career where you have to be adaptable and flexible. Things change all of the time, but things are now changing and happening at a pace that we just cannot sustain anymore. And we have more of our coworkers that are getting infected and getting sick during this holiday season. We as nurses have been shouting from the mountaintops for months for people to please stay home. if you have to go out, wear a mask, wash your hands, you know, really pay attention to spreading this disease. And there are so many asymptomatic carriers out there that just don't understand. Those people that are not sick and don't have symptoms are the ones that are out there spreading this even faster. It's been so hard fighting this battle on many fronts. Even my own family members who still do not listen to me. They do not listen to the science. You know, they call me a fear monger and tell me things like I'm washed in the blood of Christ, so I'm protected from this virus. Or I refuse to live in fear. I have, you know, rights and freedoms, and I just can't live the way that you do in isolation. My husband, my two children, and I have been in isolation since March 8th. And it has been rough, but we have found ways to adapt, and we do it because working in an intensive care unit with COVID patients every day, I don't want to potentially be the Typhoid Mary that's out there spreading this in my community. So I do it to protect my own family, and I do it to protect my neighbors, my coworkers, and people that I don't even know. It's really had a devastating toll. And honestly, it hurts my soul in a way that I can't even express. I feel like I've been betrayed by my own community with their behaviors.
You talked before, and that was quite early in the pandemic, about the incredible sacrifices you were making at home to keep your family safe. What is life like for you outside of work right now?
Pretty low key. Like I said, I really don't leave my house for any reason other than to go to work. I've left my house, actually, to be honest, exactly 2 times in 9 months for non-work related travel. And both times I felt like it was a betrayal to my profession, to my, you know, my own morals, but I had to do it for my own sanity because, you know, isolation is hard on everyone. I was diagnosed with PTSD in June after losing a coworker and after trying to fight on so many fronts and not wanting to be on the front lines of this disease. Lots of problems with feelings of betrayal. I have no trust and no faith anymore in the government agencies that were put into place to keep people like me safe. I've lost faith and trust in my employer to keep me safe as well. And I don't feel like the hero that everyone claims that we are. This is not how you treat your heroes. I know that a lot of people are facing a lot of isolation fatigue. I feel that as well. And I know that they want to be with their families for the holidays. I do too. But I still am begging the same thing I was begging 6 months ago. Please, for the love of your nurses, stay home, because we don't grow on trees and there are no more of us. We have used up all of our nursing resources. There are no more temporary nurses or travelers to be had. Now that the country is all surging simultaneously, we are out of resources. And the only way that we are going to make it through this is if people stay home and stay safe and wear a mask.
Something that I have heard people say when we're talking about hospital capacity is, oh, they'll make room. There'll be room for me.
Yes.
Can you explain that when we're talking about ICU beds, it's not just the physical bed, it's the staff that support the patient in that bed that defines it as an ICU bed. Tell us about that a bit.
Well, at the point that we're at right now, our hospital has declared this a disaster, internal and external. And what that means is we are out of space. So we may have to convert places like the conference rooms where the executives meet, you know, where they hold business meetings. We're going to have to convert that into a space where we can put people on gurneys, possibly looking at the cafeteria. They've already put out tents, you know, outside of every emergency room to try to what we call triage. And that is means measure how acutely ill you are and how infectious you are and try to separate people out. It means that we have to have discussions that are a lot more difficult inside the hospital for patients who are severely ill with multiple medical problems and let them know we are at the point where we really can't help you anymore. Having to struggle for what happens. I'm also a crisis nurse in our hospital. So that means that sometimes I will walk throughout the entire hospital and look at all of the patients and try to find the ones who look like they're getting into trouble and becoming more unstable and try to head those things off at the pass before they need an ICU bed because we don't have any. And it makes it much more difficult to try to decide, you know, who gets an ICU level, not just the bed, but the staff as well. Like I said, you know, ICU nurses don't grow on trees. And I know that the governor recently talked about this 2 days of training and you can make anybody an ICU nurse. It takes years to have the experience and the knowledge and the critical thinking skills that you need to be able to operate independently and autonomously at that level. And when you use them all up, the only thing that we can do is take care of more patients. That's why we have ratios. It means that I, as an ICU nurse, can only divide all of my time and attention between two patients and keep them both alive. It is tried and true. It has been proven to save lives, and that's why we have safe ratios in place. Now that those ratios are being threatened, I could have to try to manage two or three or four ICU patients at the same time. And I mean, you do the simple math. I only have 8 hours in a shift. And if I have to try to manage four intensively sick, unstable patients, the chances of all of them dying are greatly increased because I just cannot be in that many places at once. We are out of ancillary staff, and it's not just nurses and doctors. You have to realize we need respiratory therapists. We need housekeeping to help us keep up with the mountains of trash that get produced with all of the protective gear that we go through. We need what we call patient care technicians or nurses aides. Once these patients end up in the ICU, they're no longer functioning. They can't get up and walk around and exercise. They're going to have tubes, you know, in every orifice. They're going to be flipped over on their bellies and they're going to be paralyzed and sometimes in a coma, a medically induced coma. We have to have physical manpower and strength and people to assist us to lift and move and keep these patients' muscles from wasting while they're in these beds. It's the manpower is limited. It's not just one nurse for one patient. It's 15 employees working together to keep two patients alive. And when you don't have all of that staff anymore, unfortunately, we're going to continue to see the death toll climb.
How are things with PPE? Do you have what you need?
We do right now. I think it's because of the strong work that CNA has done to get legislation passed to make sure that hospitals have to keep a stockpile on hand. It's not a very big one, but it's a start. And that has helped us. But honestly, the threat is always there. I mean, you know, with a nationwide pandemic going on, the competition for resources really makes it hard. I had told you 6 months ago that we were struggling to work with local vendors to get, you know, hand sanitizer and bleach wipes and face shields and things like that that we needed. Those are always going to be a threat to run out. So we are very judicious. We're very careful with how much we try to go through. But again, the fear of shortages are always there. If our N95 masks run out, that's the special respirator mask that we have to use. What do we have as a backup? So right now we're scrambling to look for any supplies and any different kinds of alternatives out there that we can provide our staff with just in case we have another shortage.
When we spoke last time, you said that you just didn't know how much of this you could possibly endure. You and many nurses, that it was so exhausting, so taxing, that many were considering how long they could stay in the profession. I'm wondering, what has that thought process been like for you over the course of this pandemic?
The last few weeks have been especially hard. I've had several shifts where I thought that I had reached my breaking point, where I'd had enough, where I just couldn't do this anymore. My husband and I have talked about the possibility of what happens if, you know, I make a grave mistake and I get fired right now, because I'm telling you, the pressure that we're under, people expect nurses to be superhuman and perfect and robots, and we're not. And the more pressure we're under, the more the likelihood is that we could make a dangerous mistake. And that is truly terrifying for all of us right now, to think that we might make an error that would make something worse for a patient not only that, but we could lose our jobs in the middle of all of this. You know, it is happening. There are nurses who have had to face layoffs in some hospital systems. So the fear of not having employment, especially during the holidays, just adds to the stress. But there are several days when I just feel like I just cannot go on anymore. It's very difficult. I'm atheist, but I have a Christian friend of mine who says, you know, God only gives you as much as you can handle. And I keep telling her at this point, I should be able to bench press a Buick.
Without a doubt.
I mean, I'm trying to keep my sense of humor here, but honestly, there's not much sense of humor left to be had.
And how are you taking care of yourself? How are you managing your mental health in particular?
Lots of therapists.
Yeah.
Mental health is important. And you know what? I've been very open about my struggle with this. Like I said, and not only have I been diagnosed with PTSD during the summer, but I also have trouble with anxiety and panic disorder now. And it's really hard because
both of those things are as a result of this pandemic, just to be clear. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard when you're in a crisis situation and you feel something like a panic attack or an anxiety attack coming on because of just all of the stress and the fear and everything that's involved in what we do. And to try to control that and be able to work through that and still be able to help my patients. It's hard. Things that I do for myself, because I'm a night shift worker and I've been quote unquote vampire for about 20 years, vitamin D and sunlight are, I'm finding very important during the winter. So I have a little sun lamp so that I can get a little bit of sun inside the house. I work on a lot of crafts, baking when I have a little bit of free time, which is not much these days. And I do a lot of these interviews so that I can share my story and try to reach some of the people in the public that maybe don't understand how serious this disease actually can be.
Well, I will give you another chance to do that before we wrap up. You know, we have Christmas and New Year's right around the corner. As you mentioned before, there's extreme fatigue related to social distancing and isolation. What do you have to say to our elected leaders and to the public at this critical moment?
Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to say what I got to say. I am absolutely ashamed of our local public leaders, especially people like our county sheriff, who has declared publicly that they are not going to enforce any of the protections that our government has tried to put in place, like social distancing, wearing of masks, staying at home. And especially now that we are in a stay-at-home order for my region, and there is no enforcement going on at all. So people are not listening. They're continuing to have their holiday parties. One of my local churches just had a Christmas caroling group out this past week. A very large group of children and adults that walked around my neighborhood Christmas caroling. And we know that singing, shouting, sneezing, coughing, things like that spread this airborne disease even farther. And many of these people were not wearing masks. I was, again, had that feeling of disgust in the pit of my stomach. I can't tell you all of the things that went through my head that I wanted to say and do in that moment. But I decided to take the high ground and stay in my house where it was safe and scream from my windows. But this is what I'm talking about. This is why we're going to continue to have to stay in a lockdown. And we're going to continue to see hundreds and thousands of more people in our community die because of this just blatant disregard for this health crisis that we are in. It is not about religion. It is not about politics. It is about the preservation of human life. And that is what I am about as a nurse. And I don't see people out there really caring about each other or the people around them anymore. This is about taking care of not just your loved ones, but your community by doing something as simple as following some rules. It was difficult when people first said, I don't want to wear a seatbelt, when seatbelts were made mandatory. But, you know, that was a rule that was put in place to keep people safe and alive. This is the same thing that we are doing with the masks and the social distancing and the stay-at-home orders. We're doing this to try to keep people alive. And I am tired of watching people die one right after the other in my ICU. And I know people say, well, it's a very small percentage. Well, it's the only percentage that I see every day.
It's such an unimaginable thing that you are experiencing right now. I don't have words to describe how grateful I am for you and for all of the healthcare professionals who are showing up in our time of need. And I wish you some peace at the end of this terrible journey. Amy Arland, thank you so much for sharing your story and for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
It takes a lot to put together a great team. The right people sharing the same motivation, supporting each other. This is Tamara Keith. At NPR and Valley Public Radio, the team of news professionals we've assembled work around the clock, around the world, and around Central California to bring you fact-based news and analysis. And it's all possible thanks to some very key members of our team, sustaining members. With sustaining membership, you support the station on a monthly basis, automatically. You set the amount and the payment method. And that's it! We'll receive your gift each month until you decide to make a change, which you can do anytime you'd like. This past year has shown us all how important a reliable source of news can be. If you can contribute, we'd love to have you on our team as a sustaining member. Join now by clicking at kvpr.org or on the KVPR app.
Boy, it's great to hear from Tamara Keith, who born in the Valley, Hanford native, and now she's all grown up and doing it big time. White House reporter for National Public Radio, but still with a great connection to the Valley and to Valley Public Radio. And Tamara talked about teamwork, and it takes a great team. We're inviting you today to be part of that team. It's the last day of our winter membership drive. We want to close out the year strong and get off to a great start for 2021. Asking you to join the team by becoming a member, going online to kvpr.org or the KVPR app and clicking donate. Consider making a one-time donation or becoming a sustaining member. With me too, another member of our team, longtime member of the team, longtime listener and supporter, Valerie Smart. Hey, Valerie.
Hey, David. So we're inviting you to step on up to the plate, swing that bat and hit it out of the park with a slant, grand slam by supporting the station. That's all it takes. Joining the team makes you a hero to everyone at the station and everyone in the Valley because you're providing the news that people need to function, giving us a good, reliable source of information that we can count on. So be a great team member, support the station through kvpr.org or the KVPR mobile app. We try to make it easy on you.
That's right. It is. It's quick, safe, and secure through the app or online. And you can set up a sustaining membership where you decide a certain amount of money you give to the station every month. It just takes a minute or so to set it up, and you can be off and on your way. We know you've relied on us throughout the year and that our programming has helped sustain you. We're asking for you to help sustain us. We've worked so hard to every day bring you stories that you wouldn't otherwise hear elsewhere in any other print media or other broadcast media. The radio makes it possible to do this in a special way, but it requires an investment on your part, investment in our news team, investment in Valley Public Radio, and investment in your community. It doesn't have to be a lot. Any amount you can give will make a difference. So don't just take it from us. Here's what listeners are saying.
John in Fresno says, thank you for everything KVPR does for Fresno and the Central Valley, including Bakersfield, of course. Marv is my favorite also. Does a wonderful job from home. Sounds like he's at the studio. And thank you for the HD2 classical channel, a nice alternative to everything else now and then.
That's right. So whether you're tuning in for the news, current affairs, the fun stuff on Saturdays, the music 24/7 on our brand new KVPR classical stream, or overnight on kvpr.org, whatever it is that sustains you from Valley Public Radio, we're asking for your help. Please go online today, kvpr.org or the KVPR app and click donate. And we thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The first batches of the COVID-19 vaccine arrived in the Valley this week, and for many of us, the milestone represents a light at the end of a very long and traumatic tunnel. But it will still be months before the vaccine is available to the general public, and in the meantime, new cases are being reported at record high rates across the state and the country. Here with the good news and the bad is FM89's health reporter, Carrie Klein, for our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hello, Kathleen.
So, I don't really want to ask this, but I know that I have to.
How has the Valley fared this week?
Terribly, unfortunately. You know, there's no other way to put it. New infections are soaring. You know, in October, the Valley would see around 200 or 300 new cases in a day, and now we're up to around 2,000. And as I predicted last week, we have now broken the records we reached over the summer for new daily infections and weekly infections in this area. We've also broken the record for number of COVID patients in area hospitals. We were up to 1,200 as of yesterday, and our ICUs are also approaching record highs. For the last week, they've hovered between 0 and 5% availability for any patients, COVID or not. And sadly, around 90 people have died of COVID in the last week, way up from the lows of only a few dozen per week in October. And of course, because of all this, the ICU capacity, particularly the stay-at-home order, is still in effect for our region and will be until at least the end of December.
Okay. Well, this week's biggest news is the vaccine. California, I understand, was slated for 327,000 doses in this first wave. What has that local rollout involved?
Yes, of course. This is fantastic news. This is the arrival of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine that got emergency authorization from the FDA last weekend. Locally, we were allotted almost 17,000 doses in a six-county area of the San Joaquin Valley. For the most part, they're being delivered to county health departments. That's where they started, particularly those with ultra-cold freezers to store them. And then from there, they're distributed out to healthcare partners. The first shipments began arriving on Tuesday, and some hospitals began administering them the next day. That includes Valley Children's and Madera, but some others, like Adventist hospitals in Fresno, Kings, and Tulare counties, will not begin administering them until Monday.
And what do these vaccines actually look like? Like, paint us a picture of these little guys arriving to save the day.
Right. Well, so they were delivered in what looked like kind of typical moving boxes. It would almost be a little anticlimactic if you didn't know what was in them. And most of the space in these boxes was actually taken up by dry ice and, you know, the cold packs, keeping the vaccine at negative 70 degrees Celsius. That's negative 94 Fahrenheit, by the way. That's colder than the average winter temperatures on Antarctica. The vaccines themselves are in teeny vials stored in small boxes. And because the vaccine is concentrated, you can actually fit almost 1,000 doses in a box the size of a large hardcover book. It's really neat how little space they take up. And each box had a device on it that kept a digital log of its temperature throughout the transportation process. And that made sure that they all stayed cold until they reached those ultra-cold freezers.
So who is getting these first doses and how is that determined?
So each county has allotted a certain amount of doses for individual healthcare facilities, mostly hospitals, and then those facilities get to make their own list of who will get them. Most of them are prioritizing healthcare workers with the most exposure to COVID-positive patients. That, of course, includes doctors and nurses, but also janitors and transportation workers with a lot of patient contact.
But 17,000 doses for the entire Valley, that sounds like not nearly enough to cover everyone with patient contact.
No, it certainly will not be. I mean, there are more than 30,000 healthcare workers in Fresno County alone. On top of that, each person will need a second dose 3 weeks after the first to ensure the highest immunity possible. However, more shipments are already being planned. Governor Newsom earlier this week estimated as many as another million vaccine doses could be delivered by the end of December. That includes more of this Pfizer vaccine, as well as some from the Moderna vaccine, which is on track to get emergency authorization soon as well.
So, when are we in the general public likely to have access to the vaccine?
Not for a while, I'm afraid. You know, some health leaders have estimated as early as late January or early February, but many others are predicting the summertime, you know, after we get through not just healthcare workers, but other high-risk populations like the elderly and those in nursing homes. You know, because health officials are quick to point out this vaccine is not the solution to all our problems, and that we all need to stay on our guard and keep taking the precautions necessary to protect ourselves and bring these case rates down.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.